When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Movies That Made Me, with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
So we're back in the studios in Burbank. It's a little disorienting. It's a little strange. And Barbara Crampton's here. So I suspect that means something terrible is going to happen.
What?
Because that's usually what happens when you see Barbara Crampton, at least in my experience.
No. Oh, because most of the time I get killed or maimed.
Or you're doing the killing and maiming, not to give away anything.
Well, lately I've been doing more maiming.
Yes.
In the beginning of my career, I was killed a lot.
You were killed, but
tried to be brought back to life.
You've gone from victim to assaulter.
There's a maturity with that that kind of makes sense. Yes. You know, once you learn the weapons of destruction of the other villainous people, you can then become the villain, right?
Well, and yes, and isn't that sort of always the way that eventually the abused becomes the abuser? It's just a terrible.
Oh, yeah. My God, otherwise that's true. Oh, that's my legacy.
That is your legacy. And I guess we sort of pride ourselves on minimal to no homework with our guests. But I'm just going to, Reanimator was like one of your very first.
Yeah, I had a very small part in Brian De Palma's movie, Body Double.
Yes.
I had 3 or 4 scenes in the movie when I got the part. And then the night before they called and said, all your dialogue scenes with Craig Wasson have been cut except for the one scene. Which is sort of an inciting incident.
They actually told you about that? That's unusual.
At least you didn't find out at the screening
and go, I'm not in it.
Oh, that's true. Well, they didn't want to spend the time to film it. Although I know
They didn't even shoot it.
They didn't know. They called me the night before. They said, we're not shooting those scenes. So you only have one scene in the movie. And I thought, oh, well, it's Brian De Palma, so I should do it.
Yeah, you should do it.
It'll lead to other things.
Yeah.
And it did.
It didn't. No. No, I actually saw him in a restaurant about 20 years later. I was having lunch with a girlfriend and a safari jacket walked up to me and I looked up and it was Brian De Palma. And so I told him my thoughts about it. I said, oh, you didn't want to shoot those other scenes? And I just thought, well, I'll do it for Brian because he uses the same people like you do a lot, right, Joe? And I'm still waiting for it to happen. And so here's my number. Give me a call.
Yeah,
I never got a call.
Now he works in Europe, so I have to go to Europe. It's a trip to Europe.
Well, yeah, my husband just retired, so we're empty nesters now. Our kids went to college, and so I could go to Europe. Maybe I will. Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, that's right. I forgot, yeah. Because I love that movie. But then Reanimator.
Yes, I love the movie. But then Reanimator was my first really big thing. Yeah. And I got that part because the girl who originally had the role, her mother read the script and her mother said, oh no, you're not doing this. And you know, we're all young at the time. And my mother wasn't that much of a, you know, helicopter parent. So she didn't read it. And thank God. And then—
But then she had to see it.
My mother's passed away, God rest her soul, but I don't think she ever watched it.
Really?
Because everybody told her not to. Yeah. But listen, that movie, I mean, it didn't... It was a good movie. It didn't shock me. It did... I don't know. My sensibilities probably are a little bit different than most people, maybe. I don't know. I grew up in the carnival business, and my dad was a concessionaire with fairs and carnivals, and I traveled around with, you know, like a two-headed cow and a tattooed lady and a bearded lady and... You know, I just saw a lot of weird kind of creatures in my life growing up. And it didn't, you know, of course, it always gives you pause as a person when there's nudity involved. But as far as the story goes and everything, I didn't feel like, oh, I can't do this or I can't pull this off. And also, I felt like the character was written pretty smartly in a way. And there was enough for me to do to get over the fact that, you know, there was some nudity in the film. So it didn't really bother me at the time. And it's proved to be one of people's favorite scenes in horror history.
it's a pretty unique scene.
And that led to other things. And that movie led to other things for me.
Sure. Yeah. But I just remember that movie hit like a bomb. I mean, it was one of those films. It was that period. There were these movies that were coming out like within a couple of years, sort of Repo Man, stuff like that, where you were like, I'm going to be watching this for the rest of my life. And then here comes this amazing low budget horror film that was just so much smarter than it had any right to be, so much funnier and still terrifying and graphic, but I mean, just what an amazing piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tone was pretty interesting. I think it married comedy and horror pretty well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys know a lot about that, but it didn't really lean into the comedy so much in a way.
But it has the absurdity working for it. So
because you need the visuals are there.
Yeah.
So you don't need the actors to telegraph those moments at all. And I think that's what helped at the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it was also because Stuart came from the theater, it was very presentational in a way and almost like an opera. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really big. And Stuart came from the theater, and that was his first movie. He didn't know what he was doing. He had a good script with Dennis Paoli, and they were frequent collaborators. And all of us had worked in the theater before then, all the actors, Jeffrey and Bruce and myself. And I think we just all had a similar mindset, so it seemed to work.
Yeah, we got to see, I'm sure you've seen it, the musical.
Mm-hmm. I saw it four times. No, I saw you there. I was there. Yeah,
remember? I didn't get to wear the shower curtain and get blood on me. But
you were closer up than me. Were you behind me? I don't remember.
I was behind you.
You were behind me. Yeah.
Was that the night? Or did you go another night? Because there were a bunch of us. I remember when was that? Were you with Landis?
You had
night?
A crew with you.
I think so.
I was. Yeah. I was part of that.
You were there, but I hadn't met you yet.
But I think Stuart just said, "I think he just
yeah." Stuart just brought us all in. Yeah.
Loved it.
It was so much fun.
It really leaned into the comedy for the musical, and I think that worked. And I think Graham Skipper as Herbert West was fantastic. My husband was sitting next to me, and you know, he doesn't like horror movies, but he was the loudest laugher in the whole theater. So much so that I was like, okay, it's funny. Maybe it's not that funny, it's funny, but you know, it was I think everybody just had a really good time. Maybe except for Jeffrey. Jeffrey was a little bit like, he was like, what is going on? This is my part. Look, they're making fun of me. I think he felt like they were making fun of him, you know, to a certain degree. And it was his part that he created. And so I think he had a you know, Jeffrey's good natured and, you know, I think he got over it. But for the moment he was like, what is happening here? What is this? But I just thought it was delightful. And the girl who played my character's part, Ashley is her name, I think. I thought she was lovely. I just thought, and the music was fantastic.
The music was great, yeah.
You know? Yeah. I was a big fan of that one.
Go on the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
It did go on the road for a little bit.
It did.
Well,
that's great. Because, I love the fact that, what was it, the first five rows you had to wear? You'd have like
the splash
parkas zone. Because they would splash you with blood.
People were getting sprayed with blood. Yeah, I didn't get sprayed with blood. I would have liked that too. I didn't notice it down front.
It's great fun. But you've been in, since then, you've been in a trillion movies. And then we just saw you recently and we had your co-star on Jacob's Wife, which it's been out long enough. As you were saying, we can give away a little bit about the fact that you're chopping people up yourself and eating them and doing terrible things to them. Now you're the
spoilers.
You're the monster now. So it's
but there's a reason I'm a monster.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, there's something behind it.
It is one of the most. I don't know why it is. It's like the best movies about relationships very often, or weird genre films. But it's such a great film about marriage.
Well, yeah, we developed that. I developed that with Amp Films for about 3 years or so. We went through a lot of different writers, and it was, you know, initially when it was first written, it was a movie about a man dealing with his wife who has a terminal illness. And then we thought, well, let's turn it more, because I wanted it for me because I found it and I wanted it as a vehicle for me. So we thought, well, let's turn it around and make it more that the main character of Anne has a little bit more agency. And we also didn't want to bash the patriarchy. We just wanted to showcase a long-term marriage mm-hmm. and the ups and downs of that and how do you last after 20 or 30 years? How does that go on? And I'm a long-time married person, and so is Larry Fessenden, who played Jacob. And Larry and I have known each other for a very long time. We've worked on a few projects together. And there was a comfortability with Larry that I mm-hmm. had and, you know, just us talking about what it's been like for us being married for so long. And sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes you want to give up, but you don't. You just kind of, you stay in there. And I think we wanted to showcase a story about two people yeah. and you know, how they move on when somebody changes. And they change.
She changes.
She's got an appetite for more. That happens to be blood and guts and bodies.
You know, but it's not like the people she's killing were that.
Yeah. And for me, I also wanted to play an iconic character. I've never gotten to play that. And it's usually in times past, guys that get to play Freddy Krueger and, you know, all the great horror villains of all time. And it was really important for me in my career to have something like that at least once. And I thought to myself, maybe you think this every time you make a movie, if I could just make this one, if I could just get the money, that's all I need. I'll never need another movie. And that's how I felt making this movie.
That's great.
Of course, now I want to make the next one.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful film, and we're not just thrilled to have you on the show. We're thrilled. I can't believe we're here, Joe.
We're here in person.
Forever.
We've been doing Zooms for a long time, and you do get to look at the person on the Zoom.
Yeah,
but it isn't the same as being in the same room with them and feeling the vibe, and it just you react differently.
Sure.
Plus, we had a shower.
Yeah, you had to shower. You weren't in
and put on pants. I've done. Yeah. You'd be stunned at how many episodes I've done without pants. It's or shoes, but.
I didn't think we were going to go into that, but.
But, so Barbara, we want to talk to you here. Like, what do you like? What kind of movies?
Yeah.
What are you here to tell us about?
Well, it's funny. You said to pick 10 movies that, you know, really influenced me in my life. And as I'm writing them down, I probably had 20.
Oh, yeah.
And then maybe I had a little more than that. But in thinking about it, I was really paring it down, editing in my mind as I went along. And then I don't know. I just picked the 10 movies that really stood out to me in my life. And then I put them all together in order of when I saw them and how they affected me. And there is a story there. And I didn't know there would be a story. But I guess with all the little elements in your life, if you put things together, you can piece them together as a writer. You know, you find the connections, right?
Yeah.
So when I was younger, I used to watch Dark Shadows, and I was a kid maybe in sixth grade. Every day after school, I'd ride my bike home, and I got out of school at 2:50, and the show started at 3, so I have to really hurry. I was very scared by Dark Shadows.
Yes.
But I continued to watch it. I had nightmares. My mother said, don't watch that show. I said, I can't help it. I have to watch it. I also would come home after that show, played the Million Dollar Movie on WPIX in New York. So every day at 4 o'clock, there was an old movie. And I guess one of the earliest memories I have is of watching Danny Kaye in The Court Jester.
Ugh.
And that really had a big effect on me. And as a performer, I guess, you know, when I was younger, I thought, I do want to be an actress. And I think all kids think that. At some time, you know, I want to be in a rock band.
Right.
I want to be an actor, whatever. I want to be a singer. But I never lost that. I always wanted to be a performer. And I felt like my dad was also kind of a performer in the carnival business because he was a carnival barker. And they used to call him the best mic man in the business because he could call people in and get them to spend a quarter or a dollar, $2, $5. You know, if he got a good mark, he'd get $50 out of them. And then he'd give them a small little toy that cost $2. Anyway, I felt the same way about Danny Kaye. He kind of reminded me of my dad, and he was bigger than life and so broad in his performance. and just could do anything. He could sing, he could dance, he could make you laugh. He was a good actor. He was, you know, a romantic lead. He was everything. So that movie really stood out to me. And then
movie, can you do the thing?
Oh, let me think. The vessel with the pestle has the pellet with the poison.
No.
Is that right? No, that's wrong.
The vessel with the pestle has the pellet with the poison.
I said that. That's what I just said.
The other one has
what was the other one? The
flagon with the dragon.
What?
The flagon with the dragon.
Has the brew that is
has
true.
Has the brew that is true. Yeah. Okay.
But they get
we almost got
they
it.
Get
between
it mixed
the two
up
of us.
In the movie, too.
That's right.
They get it mixed up in the movie. Yeah, and we haven't rehearsed it, so I think we did pretty good.
That was yes.
But and that actually is, I think, the best thing Danny Kaye ever did.
Yeah.
I love that film.
I mean, it's such it works on so many levels. It's such a terrific movie. And I also saw it when I saw it in the theaters. I'm so old. I saw it in the theaters when I was a kid. And I remember kids like Danny Kaye, but that particular one was like, it was made for them.
Yeah.
And if you see it today, the screenplay is so clever.
It's so clever. Yeah. It's a little complicated, I think, but it still works, you know? I mean, I think there's some other movies that I watched in my youth that I felt like were a little more streamlined. There's a lot going on in this movie, and it was quite expensive, as I understand, for the time. They had like $3 million for the budget, which back then is a lot of money.
And a very good cast.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Sword fights.
And that sword fight, come on.
Yeah.
was like ridiculous. And they rehearsed that movie too, I think for like 3 weeks or so. They rehearsed the scenes. And funny enough, we rehearsed Reanimator as well for about 2 to 3 weeks.
It's unusual for a low budget movie.
Well, I thought this is the way it was. You know, you get a movie part and then you rehearse. That's the first time and last time that's ever happened to me. Mm. I know Mike Flanagan did it on his show, The Haunting of Hill House, one of the episodes.
Wasn't it like one shot, I think,
There was one long
mortuary.
Shot. Yes.
Yeah,
and it was during
so
the funeral.
Yeah, you would have to, right, in the funeral home.
But I think that they shut down production and they rehearsed.
Yeah.
And then they shot it pretty quickly.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And I think drama-wise, you know, and performance-wise, it's one of the best things I've seen on television.
Oh, it was amazing.
That
I love those
episode.
Moments in those kind of shots where you start to realize what's been going on and it's like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, right?
You know, they're not cutting.
They're not cutting. But in Reanimator too, I think, you know, we shot that in 21 or 22 days. And, you know, this was before a lot of people were making noise about overtime and whatever. And I got paid for all my overtime and the crew did too. But I think I made more money in overtime on that movie than I did when we were shooting it because Stuart would just never stop shooting. He would say, no, I want to do that scene one more time, or I have to do this, or we have to do that. And we'd be like, oh, all right, whatever. But it did help because he was a theater director of having rehearsal and just running the scenes and talking about it. And I think for something like The Court Jester, that is such a performance piece too. Having that is really going to help, unless you have a year to shoot it. Maybe they did. Right. I don't know what their shooting schedule was like, but.
And you also, Basil Rathbone was apparently the greatest swordsman in Hollywood.
Oh, he was like in real life?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I mean,
Ever since
swashbuckling days.
The Robin Hood
stuff.
That was something they had to rehearse.
Yeah.
And I remember I worked with a guy very early on back when it was my first job when I was a PA who did sword fight stuff. And he said the best sword fighter in Hollywood was Basil Rathbone. Oh. But the one who actually fought the way like sword fighters did in sort of those, if you watch Three Musketeers, Oliver Reed is the most accurate, you know, he's not, there's no finesse. He's just this lumbering bull with these swords going blah, blah, whacking at you over and over again. He's like, that's how they actually did it.
Oh. So. Well, they must have had, you know, stunt people back then, but maybe they didn't help them.
Yeah.
It's hard to fake that though. I mean, unless you're over somebody's shoulder, now of course you put somebody else's face on them.
But. Yeah. Drop their face on.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Does Keanu Reeves do his own action in all the John Wick movies?
I happen
to see The Matrix again on the airplane on the way back.
Oh yeah.
Which I hadn't seen in ever since it came out. And he does a lot of this mm-hmm. stuff. In
he thinks,
picture.
Yeah.
And it's a really good picture.
Oh, I know. I love it too.
It's yeah. so smart.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and I don't understand how, but both Wachowskis now, I understand, have had, are now.
Yes. They're now.
They're not the brothers.
That's it. Well, we yeah, watched, yeah. We just watched Bound the other day, which I have not seen which in is a great. Thousand oh, years.
Gina Gershon, cow, Bound?
First, that's yeah, the first, Wachowski's first film.
I saw a picture by them.
Mm-hmm. And well, yeah, it was their first. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, yeah, right. And then what did they do after this before? And you're like, no, they got The Matrix off of that film. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. It's like, you forget how good it is. I might cut this. I'll think about it because I don't know. These are touchy territory we get into.
Right?
These days. But the opening shot in Bound.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember? You're inside a closet full of women's clothes. It slowly pans down to women's shoes. You're like, they were telling us.
Yeah.
But it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. And you can see how like these, you know, they'd make this little film.
Mm-hmm.
You could see why it would explode. And you could see why some studio would go, sure, we'll give you $100 million to make a giant effects-laden movie packed to the gills with effects and movie stars. I mean, it's...
Well, the story was kind of ahead of its time, so too. Because don't we all feel like we're in The Matrix right now?
Oh,
yeah. We're feeding... We are the batteries feeding corporate society.
Yeah.
Aren't we? I mean,
by
everything
By the way, I just saw
do.
The same black cat walk by twice while you were talking. So, I mean, it's... It's a glitch in the Matrix.
Yeah. Actually, Gloria Foster steals that movie as the Oracle.
Oh, it's the Oracle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what was the, I can't remember. What's he kind of, the cookie.
The cookie
There's
lady.
Whole, the joke cookie? With the cookie, yeah. Which actually turns out to be a reference to cookies that you block in your computer.
Wait, what was that?
You know, you get like pop cookies.
She gives him cookies to take with him.
Yes.
Yeah. And
I remember that.
And it's, you know.
What happens then with the cookies?
Well, he eats one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did Alice.
Yes.
There's a lot of Alice in Wonderland stuff.
But it's also a reference to cookies in your computer.
Like
computer
the red blue or the blue pill. Or
yeah.
The,
yeah. Yeah. All that. It's magical film.
Really good picture. Yeah. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Try to find it and watch it.
So anyway, you know, the court jester really, you know, set me up as far as, you know, that's the kind of acting that I liked. I also wanted to say that I almost met Danny Kaye one time. Because he made such an impression on me. I think it was 1982. He was in the hospital at Cedars-Sinai, and I got some flowers, and I brought them to Cedars-Sinai with a nice note.
Oh, to take to
I thought it was nice. I don't know. And I was on the ground floor, and I said, oh, I'm here to deliver this to Danny Kaye's room. And they said, oh, he's up on the seventh floor. So I went up to the seventh floor. I went to the nurse's station, and I said, hi, I'm here to deliver this to Danny Kaye. She goes, oh, his room's over there, 202. I had a moment where I could have gone into Danny Kaye's room.
You chickened out?
I chickened out. Because I wouldn't chicken out today because I'm much more, I feel better about myself. I'm more confident. But back then I thought, oh, you know, I'm just a fan. I can't do that. And I said to the lady, I can't go in Danny Kaye's room. I just love his movies and I love him. And I'm sad that he doesn't feel well. And I, could you just please give him the flowers? She goes, okay, you could go in there if you want to. And I was like, I just can't. So I left my return address on the envelope and he wrote me a letter back.
Oh.
So, I mean, I have that. I still have that. And
well,
that
it's not like you didn't know what he looked like.
Yeah. That made me feel good that, you know, so I did that. I almost met him.
Hey, we just want to take a quick break from our conversation with the delightful and terrifying Barbara Crampton and thank our sponsor, MoviesUnlimited.com, the movie collector's website. They're not just huge fans of the show, but they feature many of the movies we talk about here, so you can easily find them to add to your collection. Sure, you can stream a lot of stuff these days, but when you buy your favorites, you own them. You have them forever. Most of these places, you think you own it, then you sign in one day and it's just been deleted from your collection. It's horrible. That can't happen with physical media, folks. So you can watch what you want, when you want, and there's usually a ton of great content and bonus features like director's commentary, deleted scenes, and all sorts of goodness.
Buy your favorites at moviesunlimited.com. You'll find classics, imports, hard-to-find films, and of course, new releases too. The prices are great and the choices are endless. Own the titles you love and enjoy all the bonus features you just don't get elsewhere. Whenever you want. Click the Movies Unlimited banner on our website and buy your favorites from hard-to-find films, imports, and more Go now to moviesunlimited.com, the movie collector's website, where shipping is always free on orders over $50.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Anyway, so the other people that I watched when I was younger that I also didn't meet were like Miriam Hopkins and Greta Garbo and Jean Tierney and all those ladies that I loved. And as an actress, I did sort of gravitate more towards the women's roles, and the movies that made an impression on me were probably more female-centric. So another movie that I watched when I was younger, although I forgot that I watched it. Then when I watched it again, maybe 3 or 4 years, no, maybe longer than that, like 7 or 10 years ago, because somebody recommended it to me, I watched it and I went, oh my God, that's that movie. And it was Eyes Without a Face. And I had seen that maybe at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and that movie made an impression on me because it was scary, right? The woman who had the disfigured face had something covering it, and her father doctor was trying to find a way of bringing her face back. So they were taking other women and taking their faces off and trying to apply them. Or there's one famous scene in that movie where they take the face off of one gal and then they put it on his daughter's face. And I don't know why they had these, it looked like scissors or something. And there was these things attached, you know, they'd place the skin on and then attach it with these scissors or something. I don't, it looked like scissors to me. And that scene was so horrifying, and that movie was so scary. And it's just, I think it's that when I look back now and I think about the fixed faces of a lot of villains, you know, like Freddy and
Joker.
And yeah.
Michael Myers
and whatever. It's that, although she wasn't particularly villainous, but it was very chilling and scary because it's an immovable image. And apparently I read recently that John Carpenter kind of used that model, you know, when he was making Halloween, Michael Myers, that it was this fixed sort of visage. And so that movie made quite an impression on me. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of beauty in that movie in a way with the doves and at the end and the barking dogs and, you know, just created that metaphor of this woman who was sort of caged up. Why did they have those freaking dogs? I don't know what the dogs meant, you know, in terms of the story. Mm-hmm. I get it what it meant in terms of a metaphor, but what was it with the story?
I think it was if his patients escape before they are used up, then they get fed to the dogs.
Oh, they got fed to the dogs. That's so right. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of grim,
but
yeah.
But yeah, and then she's the one that realizes that she's the monster, and so, you know, she kills her dad and
spoiler.
Something.
Spoiler.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I think the statute of limitations up on that one.
Yeah. So. Sorry, I don't know, really, even though she wasn't, you know, it was really the dad that was the protagonist, and it was
there's also the nurse, the evil nurse.
And the nurse, the evil nurse was amazing, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. Loved her. So I think, you know, I didn't know I was going to work in horror movies. Am I still working in horror movies? I don't know. I guess I am. But it's just, I think it's just, I didn't mean to do it, but it just sort of happened. But now when I look back, I go, yeah, those movies probably made more of an impression on me than a lot of other films. You know, I wasn't like a romantic comedy type viewer or whatever. And you know, another movie that made, but this is a drama, clearly, although it kind of is a psychological horror film. It's all about Eve, which is that's another movie that, you know, stellar movie in any genre. made quite an impression on me. And just the fact that there was so many female leads in that film too. I hadn't seen that so much growing up, that, you know, there was two women, you know, kind of vying for the same position, one woman trying to stay on top and then another woman trying to usurp her, and what that leads to, you know, and how they both react to that. I kind of felt like Margot Channing gave up a little too easily, though, in the film myself. Mm. You know, she just was like, she was watching this happen. And I think she was only 40 in the movie. So that's about the time that I felt like in my career, too, when I was maybe 30, 36 to 37, I stopped getting phone calls. And I stopped getting job offers and auditions and things like that. So I think, and this was many, many years ago, because I'm way older than 37 now. But I think there was a lot of truth to that. And I think it's better now. I think women are getting better roles now. There's better roles written for women. But that movie has stuck with me for a long time.
And it's a terrific script.
Yeah, it's an amazing film.
Yeah. And yeah. I think there was like three Academy Award nominations for all three women in that film too, for supporting and lead actress. Right. Yeah, I think that movie definitely stands the test of time.
I'm wondering, I feel like there's certainly more parts for women, and certainly, you know, it's nice to see, because you don't see actresses disappearing at, you know, 29 or whatever anymore, that people continue to work and be stars. But I feel like there was just this, we're still struggling to get back to it. There feels like there was this time, sort of, especially in the 50s, where there were these amazing parts for women, like unlike anything we've seen since. I mean, especially, you know, I mean, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, they got to play these incredibly complicated characters,
sure,
and they were their movies, you know, And I feel like we're still kind of not quite there.
It ebbs and flows a little bit. I think when action movies first came in, you didn't see a lot of women.
That's true.
Kind of being action stars. I mean, that's why when Linda Hamilton played in The Terminator, you went, oh, and Sigourney Weaver played an alien, you went, oh, that, okay, there's something. Yeah. But those were two examples that were an anomaly at the time, I think. You know, it was much more action-oriented for men. But in the horror genre and in this independent world that I seem to have lived in for a long time, I do see a lot more women's roles, and I definitely see people, you know, offering me kind of good stuff. There was a movie that came out recently called Relic, and then another movie called Anything for Jackson, which had an older couple in it, and it was like great, great films. You know, one was about Alzheimer's and two daughters dealing with their mom, and then the other one was about this older couple trying to bring their, I think it was their son, back to life, because he had died in a tragic accident. But it was really focused on the older couple. And I don't know, I feel like older people are kind of in right now.
Yeah,
that's good news for us.
It's good news for us. Yeah. Yeah. So there's that.
Probably not the same thing. I was just talking to a friend the other day about, I remember going to see the Rolling Stones in 1981 and thinking at the time, I mean, you know, you got to go see the Stones, but Jesus, these guys are old.
Oh, yeah, right? In 1981?
In
1981. Oh, and they blasted.
And I'm like, that's it. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what creates somebody that's lasting as far as a performer? Because, you know, as I said, I do gravitate towards the performances. You look at somebody like Betty Davis or Miriam Hopkins, although she did more theater. She didn't really do a lot of movies, but she made a huge impression. Or you look at Joan Crawford or people like that. They made, and then, you know, there's some stars of today that just keep working. Nicole Kidman, you know, and Meryl Streep. I mean, they're fantastic actors. They take risks and they take chances, and they're very full bodied in their performances. They don't disappear. And I think there's something to be said for movies that sort of the arc of the movie goes along with the arc of the character. You know, it's not so much, you know, there's a plot and it's plot driven. But if you look at, you know, one of my other picks is The Haunting. And that movie is kind of a simple story, right? But the story and where you go in the story and how you get deeper into this haunted house and how it affects everyone in the film and affects the main character and how she's going crazy, or is she, or is it really happening? You know, the character's story and story's character really works. And some of those films, I think, like another one of pick of mine is Straitjacket. You know, I mean, that's a Joan Crawford picture, right?
That's right down to the Pepsi Cola bottle.
Right, exactly. Right.
Prominently featured in the
Yes. And the so and funny. The guy who played the doctor was on the board or something.
Right.
And she had whoever they wanted to cast, or I don't know if they cast anybody, but she said, I want this guy, and he's my friend, and he's gonna play this part because I'm on the board of Pepsi Cola. So he's there, and I'm gonna drink Pepsi Cola in the film. And she had cast approval on that movie. And I don't know how many actors really get cast approval.
Well, she also, she dumped an actress named Anne Helm, who was playing her daughter.
That's right.
For whatever reason, they didn't get on.
Well, she liked
And she brought in Diane Baker.
Yes, and she liked her because they had worked together before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Diane Baker's great.
Yeah.
So I just saw the trailer for that again recently. I just read it's hilarious. It ends with a warning: this movie features hatchet murders.
Deliberately, and yeah.
So that's going to
graphically depict.
I forgot that actress was Diane Baker, and I was watching The Silence of the Lambs, and what does she play in that?
She plays the mayor
the mother of the girl who's kidnapped. Yeah, she's senator.
And I thought, who is that person? She reminds me of somebody. And then I realized, oh yeah, that's Diane Baker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always liked her.
But that movie, you know, is the trajectory of it's a star-driven vehicle, right? Yeah. And so I guess back in the days when you're under contract, they would try to do that kind of thing, right? Just, you know, if you're a contract player and they're making a star out of you.
Yeah, I don't think she was under contract then. It was William Castle was the one making it for Columbia. And I think they were very excited to get her. And they basically let her run the show.
Yeah. And yeah, and then it was kind of right after Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Right. Well, that was the moment when all of these women who ordinarily would be playing grandmothers or, you know.
Grandmothers of women, they're 45.
Yeah, because right. They were like 42. I mean.
Right. Yeah.
Now it's like, well, now wait, they can all be, quote, horror hags.
I know, yes. I love that. I love that. At my age.
And,
yeah.
You know, all these people who, you know, wouldn't ordinarily be making these kind of pictures, or certainly wouldn't have been stars, star billing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was how people in horror films, the males and the females, were always able to maintain their star status by making these pictures. Now, even though they were not considered
to be lowbrow in a way.
Or anything,
yeah,
and like sort of career lows, but they weren't, because if they made money, they were career highs.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't have had a Vincent Price having a career like that if he hadn't ended up making those pictures in the '60s.
Right. It seemed like in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane that, you know, that Joan Crawford didn't really have the showier role. Obviously, Bette Davis did. And I thought in my mind as an actor, I thought, well, she's doing Straitjacket right after this, and she's really showing off in Straitjacket.
Right.
And
yeah.
I thought, I wonder if she's doing this on, if she thought in her mind, oh, I didn't get that showy role that Bette Davis got, and I want to show off in Straitjacket.
There was a whole miniseries about the making of that movie.
It was fantastic.
Oh, yes. What was that called?
It was just Betty and... Feud?
Feud.
Betty and Joan.
I think it was called Feud.
Susan Sarandon was very believable.
She was amazing.
She
just really embodied that character so well. Yeah.
Yeah. And then somebody who played Victor Buono, I remember the guy who played Victor Buono. There was something about it. He was particularly
in the
good.
Feud?
In the, yeah. But that was pretty marvelous. That was a blast.
Mm-hmm. But now, as I've gotten older, I'm very interested in the Biddy horror. genre.
The biddy horror?
That's one way I've heard it referred to. Biddy horror.
I've never heard that before.
Hag horror. There's another term that they use for it. It's psychobiddy, I guess. And then hag horror, I don't know, just, you know, old ladies screaming for their life or something. I don't know. But it's fun. It's, you know, it's campy. It's fun. We like movies like that. We want to laugh at films and enjoy them. And I think, you know, certainly with a lot of those movies, you're able to do that. So is that in my future? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I've had a couple of roles, you know, like small roles that people maybe haven't seen.
You got a ways to go.
I'm a lot older than those ladies were when they were doing those films.
Yeah, but we live in a time now too.
We're living longer, and
yeah.
So I've been able to stretch my career out a little longer.
It's also just that terrifying thing when you realize, like, you know, for me that I'm older than Wilford Brimley in Cocoon, but you know, he was way younger than you think he was.
Wilford Brimley always looked old.
I know Wilford Brimley always looked
old. That's true.
Yeah. You know, it's but yeah, people just aged differently.
Yeah, I think they did.
I'm sure it's like all the terrible stuff we're eating and drinking that's
they were eating and drinking and smoking. Yeah.
Lots of smoking. Smoking does a lot.
They were.
Smoking does a lot.
Yeah, we don't smoke as much.
No, I had my celery juice this morning. That helps me. I try to drink celery juice every day, and, you know, I go for chemical peels on my face and stay out of the sun.
It's
and
good. Bathing in the blood of virgins.
I'm not doing that.
It's awesome.
Whatever it takes.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So what's your next one?
So the first movie that I saw in the theaters that was a horror film was The Exorcist.
Oh, that's a good place to start.
Yeah. And I was 15. And I lived the farthest away from the downtown area where I grew up in Rutland, Vermont. And we went in a big group, and I think the movie started at 3 or 4 or something like that. And so when it came time to walk home, I was going to have to walk home in the dark and be the last one. So I didn't think I could do it. And I was watching the movie, and in the middle of the movie, I said, I'm not going to make it. This movie is too scary. I can't do this. And I left. And I left all my friends there and walked home. Maybe I saw a third of the movie. I didn't see the movie again probably for 10 years or more. And that movie, there's two movies that really scared me in life. That The Exorcist was one of them. I mean, right? I think it scared everybody when... It doesn't matter who you were. It was a really scary film. And, you know, the head turning around and the pea soup and the, you know, horrible. And the voice of that other woman who I think was the voice of Pazuzu. It wasn't, you know, wasn't Linda Blair. It was just too much to take. Yeah. So,
and what was the other one? You said there were two.
Oh, the other one. So the other one was... The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I probably watched that when I was 22 or 23 or 24, around there. And I watched it by myself. And I couldn't sleep for 3 nights. And there's no blood. I came to find out later, like I didn't think about it while I was watching. There's no blood in that movie. It's just, you know, a lot of screaming.
A lot of screaming.
A lot of suggestion.
From Marilyn Burns.
A lot of suggestion.
And you know, the meat hook scene and but, you know, why is it that I love that movie?
It just seems like who?
I'd love it now. Yeah. I don't know if I loved it then. I didn't love it then.
I'll watch this by myself tonight for the first time. Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I don't
movie.
Know. What I think maybe had I done Reanimator yet? Maybe I hadn't. I don't know. I don't think I had even, we were rehearsing for Reanimator at the time. So I might have been, that would have been around the same. I was about 24 when we did Reanimator. So it might have been around the same time. And maybe I thought, maybe somebody was talking about it or something. And then I thought to watch it, but it was really frightening. And I came to know Gunnar Hansen later on. And that was pretty trippy when I first met him at a convention. I was living in New York at the time, and I was working on the guiding light. And somebody invited me to my very first convention, Monster Palooza or something, mm-hmm. was it? Maybe in New Jersey.
They still have those.
Yeah.
They still do it, yes.
Oh, yeah, they still do them. But that was my very first one. I had never been to one, and I didn't know what to expect. And they sit me down at a table next to Gunnar Hansen. And I was horrified. I was like, oh, my God, you're
Leatherface.
Was he
in character or?
No.
Oh, okay, at least.
No, he was so kindly and nice. And his day job was being a documentarian kind of writer. Mm. He was a writer for documentaries. And he showed me the ropes at the convention. I said, I got pictures made up. Nobody was, you know, people have handlers now and they book right. you for these things and they bring the pictures. And so I had made up my own 8x10s and I probably only had one type of 8x10 and I brought it. And he said, well, you know, you have to charge this amount of money. And, you know, it was $10 back at the time or something, or $5, whatever it was. Sign your name and talk to the people. And so Gunnar Hansen showed me the ropes at a convention. We subsequently became quite friendly and hung out a few times. God rest his soul. Wow. He passed away too, untimely. But that movie was really scary. And I at that time, after I did Reanimator and working with Stewart and then watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even though it really scared me, I kind of started gravitating towards the horror genre a little bit more and started watching more movies that were horror-based and started feeling like, oh, okay, maybe this is this what I do or where I live? I wasn't really sure. But then Stewart hired me again for From Beyond. And then I think after I did From Beyond, I felt like, oh, this is kind of what I do. I went to the Saturn Awards that year. And I started meeting more people in the horror genre. And, you know, I met Roger Corman. And I know you worked for him for so many years. And then did a few more horror movies. And I kind of went back and forth between soap operas and horror films because soap operas really paid the bills and they kept asking me to be on them. And it was a regular paycheck.
I would imagine
it
might be possible to make a career of that and have just completely different fan bases that never intersect.
Yeah, mostly you'd think so. Or it was like what we're saying about, you know, our respective husbands and wives, like it would be, you know, one person in the couple would be a soap opera fan and the other person would be a horror fan.
Right.
Most of the time it was the women who knew me from the soap operas and the husband
right,
who would watch the horror fan. But there's plenty of, you know, back then, even of female horror fans. But yeah, they didn't really intersect except to say that I think there's a powerful energy from horror fans and a powerful energy from soap opera fans as well. You know, the soap opera, back in the day anyway, because
right.
when I was on them, that was 30 years ago or so. And I think 50 million people a week used to watch soap operas. And now I think it's 5 million a week. So, yeah. You know, there's just too many other things to watch. There's games.
Well, I feel like I'm going to tell me I'm wrong. I mean, obviously, you know way better than me, but I feel like the soap opera fans feel like they know you as your character, right? And there's sort of
yeah. Well, what it used to be was that you as your character were in their living room every day.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was a serial. So every day your character, you would eat lunch with that character and
right.
you hung out with them. And the characters grew up on that show and they would last 10, 20, 30 years. I think Eric Braid and Hans Gudegast has been on The Young and the Restless for like 40 years now. Started out in Planet of the Apes and, you know, he landed this role and Melody Thomas-Scott,
yeah.
who worked with you,
sure.
who I worked with for 6 years on The Young and the Restless. And then once they get those roles, a lot of them don't leave. But now with television and the way television is in your living room every day and how everybody's watching Netflix, those same people in the serials are, I feel like it is the soap opera model. It's like maybe for 10 episodes or 12 episodes or 8 episodes, you live with these characters, right? Yeah. I mean, Tony Soprano, who doesn't mm-hmm. want to, you know, my husband's watching, I said he's on his third round of watching The Sopranos.
Yeah, that was the first thing we went back to during quarantine, mm-hmm. was we did the entire Sopranos again.
Yeah, so there's something about a character, an actor, you know, if you can kind of really tie into, you know, creating this iconic character and the fantastic actor who embodies that role, then, you know, you can hook people on that stuff. It's like a drug.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then, I guess another movie that really, affected me was, and because I worked, on Jacob's Wife and it was a vampire movie, I went back and was watching all the greatest hits of vampire films. And one movie stood out to me. I had watched it maybe 20 years ago, and I watched it again right before we did Jacob's Wife. And I said, you know, this is my favorite vampire movie, is Daughters of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I really like Delphine Seyrig, and, you know, I've seen her in some other things, and just the embodiment of who she was. And she was female, and there has been some female-centric vampire movies, but none to me that had the impact that Delphine had on me, just, you know, in her embodiment of that character. And Elizabeth Báthory, they called her, not Bathory. And the script was so odd and sort of, you know, ahead of its time as far as like gender politics and, you know, sexual politics. And I don't know, she was just so alluring. And, you know, I really gravitate towards that the character and the actor. And I don't know, do you guys gravitate towards that, or do you gravitate more towards the story, or
depends on the movie.
Do you think it depends on the movie?
And it does. It depends on the movie and how it hits you. And
yeah.
And if you take a shine to it, you can watch it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And if it crops up on TV while you're changing channels, I mean, there's some movies
that's it.
You just say, oh, I've just got to watch the rest of
it. Like The Godfather. I mean, you'll just watch. How many times have we all seen The Godfather? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm embarrassed. I don't think I've ever seen Daughters of Darkness. I mean, I know of it.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, I think you'll watch it now.
Harry Kummel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a Belgian director or a Dutch director.
I think he was Belgium, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's the lead actor's name? I'm forgetting
his
name.
Ben Carlin from Dark Shadows.
Dark Shadows. Yes, that's right. That movie was so dangerous because you didn't know what was going to happen. It was a lot of like wife bashing and, you know, that's like slapping his wife across the face. And he called his mother to say he kept telling his new wife, well, I can't call my mother, you know, to tell us about the marriage. She's going to be unhappy about it. And, you know, I don't know. And then the wife was saying, well, you need to call. We, you know, let's go visit, or maybe you should go visit and I'll stay in the hotel. And then he calls his mother, and it's a guy in drag. And
another director, by the way, Fonz Rademachers.
Oh, he's, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But they never explain that. Like, was
gender
that
politics.
Gender politics. So that's good. No, that's good because, but back then, to not explain that, like, did he have an affair with that guy? Was that really his mother?
That's one of the reasons the picture didn't get a lot of distribution. I mean, it came out from a very small company.
And
it played art theaters.
And because it was a little too controversial?
And it was a foreign film, and Delphine Seyrig was known mainly to people who frequented art houses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it played a lot of exploitation, you know, places, but it just didn't catch on. It was a little too weird.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'm looking it up, and you're looking at the actors and there and so forth. And, you know, there's George Jamin as retired policeman and Paul Esser as hotel clerk and Fonz Rademachers as mother.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
this gentleman.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And that's not explained. It's just.
No, it's just.
It's not explained. Like,
it's just he's the right guy for the part.
Yep.
I just thought, well,
you don't even know whether he's supposed to be
the real father, the real mother,
or whether he's, you know, it's just one of the mysteries in the movie. Makes you want to watch it again.
For the first time.
But that's kind of ahead of its time, too, because now it seems like we're seeing it in our culture and in cinema, things like that happen. And you're like, oh, you know, we go, oh, yeah.
Maybe
so
he's
what?
Trans. Maybe he's in the midst of some transition.
Could be.
Right? Yeah. So that's another film that
There are different ways to read old movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm in. I can't believe I've never seen this.
I recommend it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, did I mention The Haunting?
Yes, you did.
I mentioned The Haunting. I think those are all. I didn't mention one from earlier. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm. What?
Which one?
The is it 1930?
The Frederick March version.
Frederick March.
Yeah, that's the best one.
That's, yeah. Oh. And that's the one with Miriam Hopkins, where she, I think she played sort of a...
Champagne Ivy.
Yes. But she was a wilting violet. You know, she was hard.
She was a hooker.
Well, she was a hooker. No, but when Frederick March, you know, as Dr. Jekyll, they pronounce it Jekyll instead of Dr. Jekyll in this particular film.
Do they? I don't remember that.
I do remember that. Yeah, they do call him Jekyll.
Huh. Yeah, which is, you listen to that and you
which
go,
which may be the proper way.
Who knows?
Oh, I don't know. According to them, it was.
Is that the one that there was one of those Richard Annabelle?
Books. Yes, I think
that was the one. Yeah, because I think I know it more. There were these.
It was a series of books that came out, 70s. I think, in the 70s, where
pre-video.
They would take stills from the movie and they would do a sort of a comic book fumetti kind of mm-hmm. thing, and they would go through the entire movie, literally. Mm-hmm. And you turn
with
the pages
script.
And you read the script and see the. And I think was it a script or was it just captions under?
Yeah, there would be script. It would be like it was a shot of two people, and you'd have his line and. You know, her line or what have you.
So
you could read the entire thing and in an era where you couldn't.
They did a bunch of them.
Oh, I love that.
There were no
that.
Videos to rent or anything.
Yeah.
I also, this guy, like nobody got more shattered by the advent of video than Richard Annabelle, because the first they did these very classy ones. And then he started doing sort of pop movie. He did like Love at First Bite. They did these sort of color paperbacks. And then video came along and boom, he was just done. Because given a choice, yeah, I'd rather see the movie.
And yeah.
Good. But I love that's right. Yeah, because I think I've seen the Frederick March one once, but I must have read it 5,000
oh,
times.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's quite a performance he gives.
Quite a performance. I mean, very theatrical. And the makeup was really cool, too. And I think they did that with more of a lighting technique.
Well, for the transformation, yeah.
The transformation.
Yeah.
Because they had different gels over the lights, and then they would take the gel away, and then it would appear.
The makeup would already be there, but you wouldn't see it before.
You couldn't see it.
Like the ghost viewer from the 13 Ghosts.
Yes.
And I think the movie was made also before the censors came in. You know,
it's pre-code.
Pre-code. Yeah. And so all of the sexy stuff, which if you look at it now, I mean— Miriam Hopkins is dangling her legs over a bed. I mean, she's not really, right? She's not doing that. That's, she's not doing that much. But they had to cut some of that out, I think, when they did the re-release of it, and then they put it back in. She wasn't, as an actor, Miriam Hopkins was a real strong presence. And in that movie, she is a strong presence, but she's a real victim, you know, with such a... She starts out so strong and then really becomes a victim to him. But the emotion and the theatricality that a lot of those women had in the old days has sort of given way to a more naturalistic approach.
Well,
over
I think
the
that's
last,
just true of acting styles in general.
Of all acting styles, yes. I think that's true, yeah. But there are some women that really can chew the scenery up still. Meryl Streep can still chew the scenery when she wants to. And who's that actress? Elizabeth Moss, I feel like, really chews the scenery, right?
She can.
In The Invisible Man? How many times did she cry in that movie? I don't know, 30, 40 times. But in the series that she did, right?
Handmaid's Tale.
Just crying constantly. But, that was the choice that she made. But she makes a connection with the audience. So a lot of these women... that I feel like, you know, they're my heroes are sort of women that can make that connection. I feel like the gal from Hereditary does that too. What's her name?
Toni Collette.
Toni Collette does that too. How do you make that real connection, that deep emotional connection? So I think those were the performers, you know, in a lot of the films that were memorable to me or that I look back and I go, oh, that really affected me. you know, and made me who I am. So
it does. I mean, that's the movies that made me.
Yeah. That's why we do this. Yes. Oh, that's fantastic. No, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We've been chasing you for a while now.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Everybody's chasing her.
I know. That's why.
Get in line.
Yes, exactly. And seriously, if you haven't seen Jacob's Wife yet, it's
and particularly if you're a fan, because Barbara doesn't usually get parts as meaty as this. And
unless I gave it to myself.
Yeah, exactly. I had not realized all that. That's Marilyn Meen Moore. That's great. It's so great for you. It's a fantastic film and an amazing performance. And I wasn't going to say vampires. I didn't want to give anything away, but you did. So.
Oh, well, I think everybody knows. I mean, it's on the poster, mouth is bleeding and, I got some fangs going on.
But yeah, but if you've been in a long-term relationship with somebody who suddenly starts, spreading fangs and putting the bite on people.
Maybe it's not so bad. Yeah,
This will help you cope, I think. It's a therapeutic film. Well, Barbara, thank you so much. And thanks for coming to the studio.
I'm so happy to be here with you guys. Thank you so much.
It was a great time. So
thanks.
We'll see you at the movies, I guess. Woo-hoo. We're the official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.